evil," said Hester. "If he banished her, it's irrevocable. Unless he let her back in himself. And that would be difficult, considering he's dead."
If a boy broke the princes through the shield, why couldn't Evelyn break through too? Agatha countered.
"Even if she did, the castle would have evicted her the moment she stepped inside," said Annadil. "Besides, I still find it hard to believe a boy cracked that shield open. Someone surely helped him who knew Lady Lesso's spells."
"But if Evelyn Seder isn't allowed in the castle, how is she here?" Agatha asked, still baffled.
"The question isn't how, it's why. Remember what Dovey and Lesso told you? She's part of your fairy tale somehow," said Hester. "So what do we know for sure about Evelyn Seder? First, she's Professor Seder's sister. Second, she hears things. Third, your and Sophie's kiss let her back in this school. Somewhere in there is the answer to why she's in your story."
Agatha saw Dot thinking hard, nibbling on an artichoke leaf. "Dot, when I wrote Daddy last year about history of villains and how boring Professor Seder was, I remember him writing back that he thought she was long gone," said Dot. "Been ages since Daddy was at school, so I figured he'd got mixed up. But now I wonder," she turned to the girls, "do you think Evelyn used to be a teacher here?" Hester was already ripping a textbook out of her bag.
"Chapter 28, on notable seers in our history book, it mentions August Seder and his family. I remember thinking it odd a teacher wrote about his own relatives."
"Only you would be looking at chapters that weren't assigned," Annadil murmured.
"Because I don't want to end up in an oven like my mother or impaled in a barrel like yours," Hester fired back,
flipping pages until she finally reached the one she wanted.
"Of course. Chapter 28, notable female seers," Hester growled
and snapped the cover shut on A Student's Revised History of the Woods.
"Yuba was right about her tampering with the books."
She peered up at Agatha.
"Best way to avoid someone finding out your history is to rewrite it, don't you think?"
"Here's what I don't get," Annadil proffered. "Dovey and Lesso say she caused Sophie's witch symptoms."
"They said either it's her or Sophie, and we know it's not Sophie," Agatha answered, equally puzzled. "But why would the dean want me to think my friend was a witch?"
"Unless she wanted you to go to Tedros all along," mulled Hester, gnawing on her lip.
Even the rats went quiet. Hester turned to Agatha.
"Look, we're stuck in trial tryouts for the next 3 days. But the teachers are right. You have to follow Seder and find out what she's up to. Let's reconvene book club each night to go over what you've found."
"But how?" Agatha pressed. "How can I possibly follow the dean without being..." Her voice suddenly petered away, her gaze drifting towards Beatrix's bed.
"What is it?"
Hester said. Screeching hisses and crackles erupted at the door, and all the girls swiveled to see rats gobbling up butterflies trying to slip into the room.
"Hurry," Annadil snapped at the witches. "The dean will know something's up."
"Sorry, we can't help you,"
Hester groused to Agatha, shoving Dot towards the door. "You can help me use this," Agatha's voice said behind them. The witches turned to see Agatha holding up a shimmering snakeskin cape. "Seems like Beatrix has been keeping secrets," Agatha said, brows raised. Hester's mouth curled into a wide grin. Though the butterflies heard four people leaving the room, witnesses in the hall would later insist to Pollux They'd only seen three. With the Dean teaching her version of history in Good Hall most of the day, Agatha detoured to the Library of Virtue, hoping to find out more about the history of Evelyn Sader. Under her new invisible cape, still reeking of lavender perfume, Agatha slipped through Hansel's Haven, past Professor Sheik's class, undergoing a sword-shrinking tryout to magically whittle down a boy's blade, past Professor Anemone, barking at Yara for traipsing in late to a spell-sparring tryout, and past Professor Dovey, who seemed to glance in her direction, while forcing girls in a boy diplomacy tryout to talk down blood-hungry phantoms with compassion and common sense. Agatha hustled up the back stairs to the library's entrance, where the sundial clock glittered high over the two stories of fiery red and gold bookshelves in the early afternoon light. She rushed past the librarian's desk and froze. For the first time in her 2 years here, the tortoise was awake. Stooped over his giant library log, the reptile slowly spooned a runny salad of tomatoes and cucumbers into its mouth with the feathered end of his pen, spilling a fair bit in its lap. Between old age, arthritic limbs, and a tortoise's nature not to hurry, each bite took as long as a normal three-course dinner. Impatient, Agatha tiptoed past him, careful to time her steps with the tortoise's chomps, and hurried to the back of the first floor, where the history books were kept. There had to be something here, Agatha thought as she scanned the shelves, a few butterflies circling overhead. Something about the school's history that Evelyn hadn't doctored or expunged. But as she read the book's spines, Agatha's stomach sank. The history of princely failures. Rapunzel, the real giant killer. A chronicle of fraudulent prince rescues. The fragile male, the decline of a redundant species. The hidden history of Snow White's divorce. Agatha slumped to the floor. The Dean had covered her tracks even better than she thought. Agatha looked up, discouraged, and saw the tortoise glaring right where she was sitting. Agatha didn't budge, knowing it couldn't possibly see her under her cape. And yet, its shiny black eyes stayed fixed on her very spot, blinking heavy lids, the reptile's body motionless. Still watching her, the tortoise slowly reached back, with stubby arms, and pulled off its mottled shell. From inside its body, it silently drew out a single thick book and slipped it onto the edge of the desk. Then it replaced its shell and resumed chewing, eyes on the remaining heap of his lunch. Agatha gaped at the book, haloed by the sun streaming through the second-story windows. Giggles echoed outside, along with nearing footsteps. Instantly, Agatha flung up and raced towards the desk, scooping the book under her cape just as Arachne and Mona entered, too immersed in gossiping to notice the breeze that ruffled their hair. Under her invisible snakeskin, Agatha sprinted upstairs to Honor's rooftop and closed the frosted door behind her. Braving the icy winds, she wove through Guinevere's hedges, peppered with idle doves, to find the last one, the pond scene near the balcony, secluded behind a wall of purple thorns. She sat on its shores and pulled the book from under her cape. A Student's History of the Woods, August A. Sader. Agatha let out a rush of air and gripped her old history textbook to her chest. Leave it to a librarian to find the book she needed, she thought, silently thanking the tortoise. What did he want her to find in its pages? Agatha caressed the book's silver, silk-clothed cover, embossed with the glowing Storion clutched between black and white swans. She thumbed open the thick textbook to see no words, but a familiar rainbow of raised dots in neat rows, small as pinheads. Though Professor Seder was blind and couldn't write history, he had seen it and found a way for his students to do the same. As Agatha ran her fingers across the rows of dots, ghostly scenes magically unfolded atop the book page in three dimensions, playing out to Seder's narration. The same scenes the Dean had revised in her new edition, so girls no longer knew what was true and what wasn't. Agatha swept her fingers across pages, fast-forwarding scenes until she found the page she wanted.
Chapter 28. Notable Seers,
boomed Professor Seder's warm, deep voice. A small, silent scene fogged into view atop the book page, a vision of three old men, beards to the floor, standing in the schoolmaster's tower with hands united. Agatha hunched over to watch the scene as Seder's disembodied voice continued.
As we learned in Chapter 1, with the three seers of the endless woods, seers commonly share three traits. They live double the lifespan of ordinary humans, they age 10 years as punishment if they answer a question about the future, and their bodies can host spirits with deadly effect.
Agatha's hands scanned through the chapter, past scene after scene, until her fingers stopped suddenly, in the middle of the page, finding a few rows of polished dots that looked newer and shinier than the rest. Curious, she touched the first new dot. Instantly, a man's handsome face sprung into the mist, a face Agatha recognized immediately, with silvery grey hair and hazel eyes. Her throat tightened as she gazed at her old history professor from the School for Good, blinking back at her in phantom blue glow. Agatha swallowed and forced her fingers to keep moving.
The Seders are the longest and most successful line of seers. The most recently deceased member of the Seder family is the youngest son, August, who perished during the tale of Sophie and Agatha. After the great war between the two schoolmaster brothers of good and evil, August Seder had long believed the good brother created a spell against his twin before he died, a way to prove the balance of good and evil still intact, and hidden the spell in the uniform crests of the students. When the evil brother destroyed this balance by killing a student under his protection, the spell unlocked, bringing the good brother's ghost back to life. As a seer, Seder sacrificed his body to the ghost, allowing the good brother to slay his evil twin and restore the woods to balance.
Agatha's hand stilled on the page, her heart sinking. That's why the dots were new. He'd added his own death before it happened. She watched Seder's ghostly face, frozen atop the book, smiling softly at her, the way he had when she first entered the School for Good. Perhaps he'd foreseen, even before she'd arrived, that he'd die for her. And still he'd smiled at her. Still he'd helped her. Agatha could feel her chin quivering. She'd never regretted not having a father. She'd never let the thought in. Not until this fleeting moment, when she realized what it must mean to have one. A tear splashed through the misty vision, dissipating her dead professor's face. Agatha wiped her eyes and forced her hand to keep moving along the rest of the new dots.
In addition, August Seder is believed responsible for the arrival of unenchanted readers into the endless woods. After the evil schoolmaster killed his good brother in order to control the Storian, the magic pen instead responded by making good win in every new story, an eternal reminder that evil was incapable of true love. To find a weapon even stronger than love, the evil schoolmaster sought out every seer in the woods until he found August Seder,
who, in exchange for a faculty position at the School for Good and Evil, revealed that the weapon the schoolmaster sought would come from beyond the woods. Seda's prediction would come to be known as the Reader Prophecy, the most famous prophecy to emerge from the all-male Seda lineage of seers. Agatha bolted straight. A lineage of boys. She reread the line agape. How could August Seda have a sister in a lineage of boys? She flipped pages anxiously, the dots no longer new, scanning dense Seda family trees and visions of Professor Seda's brothers and nephews, until she reached a blank page, signalling the end of the chapter and the end of the trail. Apparently, Seda didn't think his sister was worthy of mention, Agatha thought, grimacing. Frustrated, she was about to fling the book into the pond, when she suddenly noticed a row of teensy, shiny new dots, footnoted at the bottom of the blank page. Squinting closer, her nose practically to the book, she touched the first dot, and a small, two-dimensional portrait melted into yellowing mist. Small as a postage stamp. A ravishing, gap-toothed woman smiled through the portrait frame, with flowing chestnut hair, bee-stung lips, and forest-green eyes. Agatha's pulse quickened, and her fingers raced on.
There is one more member of the Seda family that deserves mention. As a condition to the schoolmaster for answering his question, August Seda asked that he teach history at the School for Good, and that his half-sister, Evelyn, teach history at the School for Evil. However, as the illegitimate daughter of Constantine Seda, Evelyn Seda is not considered part of the Seda line, nor possessed seer powers. Evelyn Seda taught for 2 months before she was evicted from the school forever by the schoolmaster for crimes against students. August Seda took over teaching her classes in the School for Evil until his death.
The dean's portrait hovered in mist as Agatha's hand shook on the last dot of the page, her old professor's words ringing in her ears.
Crimes against students.
Crimes so terrible, so unforgivable, that an evil schoolmaster had banished a teacher from his own side. Agatha's heart stopped. What had Evelyn Seda done? Suddenly, the dean's phantom portrait glowed hot red over the book, and her face spun sharply to Agatha.
"Unauthorized book," she hissed. "This book is unauthorized."
Instantly, the page turned razor sharp and flew shrieking out of the book, slicing Agatha's chest with a vicious paper cut. Terrified, Agatha tried to make her finger glow, but more screeching pages sharpened and tore from the book, cutting her from every direction. Agatha backed against a hedge, batting pages away, trying to focus on her finger glow, but there were dozens of pages now, slicing at her arms, belly, legs, until her whole body was on fire. Gasping, she tried to scream for help, only to see hundreds of pages rip from the book and fly at her face, turning knife-edged for the kill. With a cry, Agatha finally felt her finger burn gold and stabbed it at the pages. A thousand white pages turned to white daisies in mid-air and fluttered down into the pond. Panting, Agatha stared at the floating flowers, flecked with her own blood. A booming crash exploded from the Library of Virtue below, sending the doves in the hedges scattering. Agatha's eyes flared wide. She swept on her invisible cape and staggered out the frosted door, stumbling down the stairs and lurched into the library. But its keeper was gone from the desk, his feathered pen left behind with a half-eaten lunch dripping off his log. In the centre of the room, Mona and Arachne sat white-faced at a library table, parchment and books strewn in front of them, gaping up at the second-floor window. Agatha slowly tracked their eyes to the giant smashed hole in the glass, shaped like a tortoise. Soft scratching sounds etched behind her, and Agatha turned to see the feathered pen magically writing in the log, dragging and sputtering with each stroke, as if in pain, before collapsing to the desk, dead still. Heart skittering, Agatha stepped closer, until she could read the tortoise's last words.
"Beware the trial."
"Hurry, Sophie," Agatha prayed. Sitting in her window, she looked out at the school for boys as the sun set, her blue bodice splotched with blood, her arms and legs scraped and bruised. Next to her, a green flame glowed inside a circular lantern she'd made out of parchment. Sophie would flash her lantern back any minute now, green if she was safe too, red if she wasn't. Agatha watched the clock. 7:15. 7:30. But still no glow came from the boys' school. Agatha could still feel her heart beating, the tortoise's warning tattooed in her skull. 2 days until the trial. 2 days. She and Sophie had to get out of this school now. Her eyes darted back to the clock. 7:45. 7:50. No light from the boys' castle. 7:55. Sophie was alone in there with her prince. Her evil prince. Her evil prince, who she dream-kissed this morning, not looking evil at all. "Shut up," Agatha berated herself, whipping back to the clock. 8 o'clock now. She heard swelling buzz in the halls, girls returning from supper. Agatha broke into a sweat. Wherever Sophie was, she was in trouble. She lunged towards the door, panting with pain. She had to rescue her friend. Agatha froze. Slowly, she turned back to the window, eyes wide. High in the sky, across the bay, a green flare flashed behind thin clouds. Agatha stepped closer, squinting as the mist broke apart. The green glow wasn't coming from a balcony or a boy's castle spire. It was coming from the schoolmaster's tower. Agatha's breath left her. She waved her hand in front of her lantern, flickering the flame. Far away, Sophie did the same. Agatha's eyes popped, relief crashing over her. Sophie was already in the tower. She'd free the Storian any minute. Breathless, Agatha slung on her cape and raced out of the room, leaving symptoms, dream kisses, and Evelyn Seder behind. As she rushed down steps, she could feel the pen getting closer, the end spilling from its nib. She'd hover by the shore for Sophie's return, a wish waiting on the tips of their tongues. The tower would chase her, the boys mobbing behind for war, only to see two girls splinter to light and vanish, hand in hand. A trial thwarted. A happy ending restored. Two friends home. Stronger than before. But the night came and went in gusts of cold. And Sophie didn't come back. Chapter 19. 2 days left. The boys in line for breakfast gave Philip a wide berth when he shoved by, covered in dust and ash, eyes bloodshot and bruised, smelling like a barn in summer. As the enchanted pots in Evil's supper hall slopped scrambled eggs and a mountain of bacon into her rusty pail, Sophie blinked back tears, reminding herself that boys don't cry. She should be home by now, back in her own skin, Agatha at her side, the end, written and sealed. And yet, here she was, with her elephant shoulders, hairy legs and hormonal rages, letting pots heap greasy bacon that the boy hijacking her body couldn't wait to eat. Last night, Manly had been waiting for her when she climbed in for Storian duty.
"Already searched 1,000 times," he scoffed. "Castor thinks we need young eyes."
Sophie grimaced at the plundered mess once he left, a heap of broken bricks, fallen fairy tales, dust and soot, but still had hope she'd succeed where they failed. She spent the entire night scouring the schoolmaster's chamber, tearing up loose bricks, muscling behind bookshelves, shaking out fairy tale after fairy tale, while her and Agatha's storybook seemed to leer at her from atop the stone table. In the end, when Castor appeared at first light, she faced him, empty-handed like the rest.
"A useless prince! What a surprise!"
the dog snapped, kicking at a few loose silver bricks with his paw.
"Pen has to be in this room, or the tower wouldn't still be here."
He looked out the window at the glass castle across the bay.
"Pollux would have loved a good game of hide-and-seek. Two heads better than one for this kind of thing."
His big black eyes seemed to mist up.
"Let me keep looking," said Sophie quickly, shaking out the ugly duckling.
"You had your chance, Philip,"
Castor growled, shoving her towards the window. Sophie nodded and slumped onto the blonde-haired rope, knowing she'd failed her mission.
"Tell Tedros he better pray we find it,"
Castor said behind her.
"Storian falls into the Dean's hands, and all of us are doomed."
Sophie slid quietly down the sunlit hair. Now she dumped herself at a small round iron table, sore from crouching and digging, and wolfed down fistfuls of bacon and eggs, no longer in control of either her hands or manners. Had Tedros lied to Manly and hidden the pen to keep it from her and Agatha? Or was he telling the truth, that someone else had found and hidden it? In which case, who and where?
"Storian ain't your problem, mate," Chaddick said, plopping down at the table, his eggs doused in chili sauce. "Teachers tried for a week, just using boys as slave labor now."
"Why do you think the new princes helped you cheat too?" chimed Nicholas, chomping crispy bacon as he sat down. "No one wants Storian duty."
"Worth it, though, to see Arik's scowl when you won first day," Ruven smirked, squeezing in with Vex and Brown. "Lucky he'll be on your team, already planning on murdering the girls in the trial instead of making them surrender."
Sophie stiffened, seeing Arik at the head table with his henchmen all eating triple portions. 2 days until she and Agatha went into the trial against those brutes. She had to find that pen tonight.
"Bet Tedros didn't expect a tag team yesterday,"
Vex said to her, pointy ears wagging.
"All of us making sure you beat the stuffing out of him."
"How about an encore today?"
Sophie simpered anxiously. Chaddick snorted.
"First off, an encore? Never heard that out of a boy's mouth who wasn't an apple tart. Second, think it's about time you handled your own self. Don't want you in the trial if you don't deserve to be there. Slavery on the line and all."
Sophie reddened. How could she get back on Storian duty if she didn't have help? She shoveled eggs into her mouth, trying to avoid any further blunders.
"Hi, Philip."
She looked up to see Hort try to sit next to her.
"No room," said Chaddick, scooting over and blocking him.
Drowning in his oversized uniform, his pouty lip quivering, Hort looked like a child spurned from his own birthday party. He gave a weaselly whimper and trudged away.
Sophie's eyes flared. "Hort, sit here."
Hort turned, beaming, and plunked next to her, ignoring all the other boys' grumbles.
"Do you want my bacon?"
he yacked, sliding his pail to Philip.
Can't touch the stuff. Dad gave me a pet pig once and said I'd have to kill it someday. It's what most evil parents do, make their kids eat their pets.
Tedros might beat me today, Hort, Sophie whispered, trying to sound guileless. What do I do?
That's what best friends are for, Philip, Hort whispered back mischievously. And to tell you that you cross your legs like a girl.
You'll help me, Sophie brightened, breathing relief.
Just like you'll help me when the time comes, said Hort,
suddenly looking very serious. Sophie smiled tightly and dug into his bacon, praying she and her real best friend would be long gone before she ever found out what this weenie expected in return. I must have missed a corner last night, Sophie thought, hastening through the sewers as she bit into an apple. The Storian was so thin and sharp it could be stashed in the cracks between silver bricks, or even in the cloth of a book spine. And yet, wouldn't she have heard it, thrashing and struggling somewhere? Temples throbbing, Sophie turned the corner past the churning red moat. Tonight she'd look harder. She pulled open the door to the doom room, desperate for a few minutes of sleep before class. Tedros looked up from his bed, stopping her in her tracks. His eyes were puffy and red, dark bags beneath them. His skin had gone from tan to ghostly pale, the veins showing through, and Sophie could see his shivering, starved muscles taut over jutting bones. There were no bruises on him, no wounds or welts, and yet everything in his eyes said he'd been tortured beyond what a boy could handle.
"What did Auric do to you?" she said softly.
Tedros bent over, face in his hands. Sophie walked up to him and held out her half-eaten fruit.
"Please."
Tedros smacked it out of her palm, and the apple skidded to a filthy corner.
"Get away from me," he whispered. "You have to eat something. Get away from me!"
he screamed into her face, his cheeks red as blood. Sophie fled the cell as fast as she could, his echoes chasing her all the way.
"I can't do it. I can't cheat," Sophie said to Hort as they headed into Evil Hall for weapons training. "Not if it means he's tortured again."
"Well, do you want Auric to torture you?"
Hort snapped. Sophie fell quiet, looking back at Tedros, clutching his own arms, barely able to walk. Guilt rose into her throat. "What's wrong with me?" she scolded, turning around. Why was she caring about Tedros? Why was she worrying about a boy who wanted her dead?
"Fine. Stick with the plan," she gritted to Hort.
"There's my best friend,"
Hort beamed chummily.
"We'll make a great pair in the trial, won't we?"
Sophie frowned.
"Hort, you're not even close to making the trial team."
But the weasel was already whistling and motoring ahead. For the first three tryouts, Hort's deftness at cheating and Sophie's skills as an actress helped her win first rank each time without any of the teachers or boys noticing. Hort magically moved her arrow to the Phantom Princess's heart in the archery tryout. Charaded answers during a "Do You Know Your Monsters?" oral quiz, and tasted her plant leaves during a poisoned or palatable survival challenge so she'd emerge unscathed. By lunch, Sophie caught all the boys eyeing Philip of Mountanora with newfound respect, as if he surely deserved a spot on the trial team. Even Auric's glares looked less baleful, as if a teammate like Philip was the reason he'd brought the new princes through the shield in the first place. But Tedros knew Philip was still cheating. He didn't say a word to the boys or to the teachers, but Sophie saw him, glowering darker at her after every new tryout, as if he'd never seen anyone so evil. By the third tryout, he wasn't even trying, and by the last, when Mosin the hairy giant leading forest groups threw Tedros and Philip into a ring for a magical sparring tryout, a one-on-one bare-knuckled brawl with no rules, Tedros simply dropped to his knees and conceded, before they began, cutting into Philip with a withering glare. The boys cheered raucously, anointing the new boy the winner for a second day, but as Sophie looked into Tedros's cold eyes, seeing right through her, she felt not even a shred of victory. "Why isn't Sophie back yet?" Agatha thought, scuttling through the purple breezeway to Charity under her invisible cape. Last night, Sophie's lantern had glowed safely from the schoolmaster's window, and yet she hadn't returned with the pen, which could only mean one thing. She couldn't find it. Agatha's breath shallowed. Every second brought her and Sophie closer to the trial. If Sophie couldn't find that pen, Agatha's gut twisted, remembering the tortoise's warning. She had to find out what the dean was planning. She'd spent the morning hiding under her cape and waiting for Evelyn outside Good Hall, hoping to follow her between her history sessions. As each new class began, Agatha peeked through the doors to watch her take a group of girls inside Bluebeard, a gruesome tale of a husband who murdered all eight of his wives, which left the girls looking nauseous. "I show you this story, not to frighten you," the dean said to close class each time, "but to remind you how vicious the boys will be during the trial. Do not expect them to wait for you to drop your kerchief or to settle for your surrender." She smiled thinly. "Nor should you give them the same courtesies." As the dean sashayed out of the ballroom between sessions, Agatha tried to follow her, but maneuvering invisibly through crowded hallways required agility and grace, neither of which was a strength. After losing the dean four times, Agatha slackened against the wall, discouraged. "Really, Pollux, I'm fully capable of getting lunch by myself," huffed Professor Dovey's voice behind her. Agatha looked up to see Pollux's furry head attached to a rickety old owl's body, flapping after the green-gowned professor.
"Strange business of late," Pollux panted. "Voices in sewers, butterflies eaten by rats, ghosts bumping girls in the halls. Dean's advised me to keep a close eye on both you and Lesso until the trial."
"Perhaps if Evelyn hadn't taken my office, it would be easier to find me," Professor Dovey fired and hurried down the steps, Pollux's owl sputtering behind her. Agatha's eyes bulged wide. With 30 minutes left in class, she scurried up Charity's spiral glass steps to Professor Dovey's old office, the lone white marble door on the 6th floor, once inlaid with a single emerald beetle, now a blue butterfly. Agatha peered down the stair gap and made sure no one was coming up. She tried the silver door handle, but it was bolted shut. She shot a shock spell at the keyhole with her glowing finger, then an even more useless melt spell, then a desperate freeze spell. The lock caught. Agog at her luck, Agatha grabbed the handle, only to see it opening from the inside. Panicked, she ducked against the stairway banister as the door flung wide. A girl poked her long-nosed, freckled face through, eyes darting right and left, before she hurried out the closing door and nimbly slid down the banister to the floor below. Crouched on the ground, Agatha gaped at the girl's red hair flowing out of sight. What was Yara doing in the dean's office? Suddenly Agatha heard a creak behind her and whirled to see the door closing, about to bolt shut. She stabbed out her foot.
jamming it just in time. Professor Manley came by the Doom Room twice before supper, promising to feed Tedros if he told him where the Storian was. Tedros begged and pleaded for mercy, but he had no new answers. Manley left the prince hungry once more. Light used to come through the sewers at sunset when the sinking sun's reflection over the bay fractured to slivers, spilling red-orange glow from the good tunnels into evils. Now, the prince sat on his metal bedframe in perpetual darkness, listening to the churning moat slap against the rocks that blocked the two sides from each other. It had been 6 days since he'd eaten. His heartbeat puttered sluggishly, like a dying piston. His empty stomach hurt so much he couldn't stand. His teeth had started to chatter, even in the sweltering tunnels. He wouldn't survive punishment tonight. The cell door unlocked and creaked open, but the prince didn't look up. Not until he smelled the meat. Philip slid a pail of braised lamb chops and mashed potatoes in front of him and stepped back.
"Told Manley it was for Castor," he said in his strange, affectedly low voice. "Told Castor it was for Manley."
Tedros peered at the elfin prince, so strong and yet delicate, like a boy who wasn't sure how to be one. He smiled too much, stood too close to the other boys, played with his hair excessively, ate in oddly small bites, kept touching his face like he was checking for pimples, and yet, strangest of all, were those eyes. Philip's big, emerald eyes, sometimes ice-cold, sometimes deep and vulnerable, as if flickering between good and evil. Once upon a time, Tedros had been taken by eyes just like them. He'd learned his lesson. Tedros snatched the pail and flung the food against the stone wall, splattering Philip with grease. He dumped the pail to the floor with an ugly clang and sat back down on his bed, panting. Philip said nothing and slouched down on the edge of his own bed. The two cellmates hunched next to each other in dead silence, until the door creaked open once more, and a dark shadow floated over them.
"No,"
Philip gasped, looking up at Arik, a coiled whip on his belt.
"You'll kill him. Late for Storian duty, aren't you?"
Arik sneered.
"Look at him,"
Philip pressed, voice straining.
"He can't survive."
But Arik's violet eyes had drifted down to the empty pail near Tedros's bed.
"Stealing food, I see,"
he leered at the prince, fingering his whip.
"Perhaps we'll start with extra punishment tonight."
"No,"
Philip cried. "It's my fault. Tedros, tell him."
Tedros silenced him with a glare and turned away coldly. Tedros heard Philip stop breathing behind him, realizing he wasn't wanted. Philip's shadow hovered on the wall a moment longer, then finally slumped out of the cell.
"Hands on the bricks,"
Arik ordered the prince. Tedros turned and put his hands high on the rotted wall. He heard the soft snap as Arik unhooked the whip from his belt and the panicked thumping of his own heart, telling him that one of these lashes would kill him. He didn't want to die. Not like this. Not worse than his father. Tears rising, limbs shaking, he looked up at Arik's shadow on the wall, uncoiling the whip. The shadowed hand rose with the handle and then swung full force, the first lash hissing towards his back. Arik's shadow lurched on the wall and the whip cracked sickly against someone else's skin. Tedros spun around. Philip had Arik by the throat against the bricks, the whip coiled around Philip's bleeding forearm.
Tell the teachers that if anyone tries to hurt him again, they'll have to get through me.
Philip snarled. Tedros blinked hard, unsure if he was alive or dead. Under Philip's tightening grip, Arik looked nervous, before he managed a cruel smile and wrenched away.
Just what we need in the trial. Someone who puts loyalty first, he said, leaving quickly. I'll talk to the teachers about finding you a more suitable room. Fine right here, Philip barked after him.
Tedros's eyes were the size of marbles now. Slowly, he turned to Philip, who bared teeth at him, cheeks blushed furious red.
Either you eat now, or I kill you myself, Philip lashed.
This time, Tedros didn't argue. Agatha gazed up at the grandmother clock in the corner of the study. 10 minutes before the next class break. She peered around at the dean's office, which was strangely barren. Where Professor Dovey's desk had once teemed with broken quills, ranking ledgers, and scrolls under pumpkin paperweights, Evelyn Seder's desk was clean. Empty mahogany, with only a tall, thin candle in its corner, the color of parchment. Why had Yara been in here? Agatha wondered. She was sure she'd heard Yara speak to the dean that day in the gallery. Something about letting Yara stay. Agatha brushed the thought away. She should be focused on the dean, not some crackpot girl who might or might not speak. Agatha hunched in the sturdy wooden chair behind the bare desk, each minute ticking by. She stared distractedly at the candle wick. The dean had arrived the day the School for Good and Evil became the School for Boys and Girls. Which meant her and Sophie's fairy tale had killed the schoolmaster and then let an evil teacher he'd banished back in. But why? Agatha remembered what Dovey and Lesso had said. Sophie's symptoms had come either from Evelyn or Sophie herself. There were no other suspects. Evelyn had been convicted of crimes against students before. Evelyn had been in the room for all of Sophie's symptoms, the beast, the wart, the corrupted Mogriff. Why am I thinking about this? Of course it had to be Evelyn. It was Evelyn. And yet, if it wasn't Evelyn... Agatha closed her eyes, letting a dream back in. He'd looked so calm. So happy, his golden hair haloed in snow. She could see his crooked smile, his shirt laces undone, as they were when he once asked her to a ball in this very same school. As if everything since had been a wrong turn in their story, as if all of this was a big mistake. She tasted his lips again as he held her, her heart fluttering against his. Fluttering more than ever before. Agatha's eyes flashed open to the cold, empty office. This time it was more than a dream. Her heart was still wishing for Tedros, wishing even stronger. Agatha scorched red. She was still wishing for her prince over her friend, her loyal friend, who was risking her life to save them from the very same boy she was wishing for? Agatha pushed up angrily from the desk, hating the weak, foolish princess inside her, the princess she couldn't silence. Then slowly, Agatha sat back down. There was an odd, jagged wrinkle in the candle's texture. She reached out and touched it, expecting to feel wax, only to feel paper instead. She pulled the candle closer and saw a camouflaged scroll bound tightly around it. Tied with a small white string. Agatha tried to settle her emotions, knowing the dean would be back any moment. She carefully untied the scroll, lifting it off the candle, and spread its parchment across the desk. There were 3 pages. The first was a map of the Blue Forest, the same map the students received every year in forest groups with all the notable areas labeled. The Fernfield, turquoise thicket, blue brook. Then Agatha noticed one of these areas circled in red ink, the lone marking on the page strangely conspicuous. She stared at the circled label. The Cyan Caves. The teachers never mentioned the caves, nor took students there, presumably because there was no way up the jagged cliff face, nor any reason to explore empty caves. Why had the dean marked them? Agatha moved to the next sheet. A letter with a broken seal of a scarlet wax snake. It was dated today. Dear Evelyn, so that there is no room for ambiguity, here are the rules of the trial. 1. Tomorrow at noon, I will meet you at the Blue Forest Gate. As the acting deans of our schools, each of us will have 30 minutes to lace traps into the arena. The Cyan Caves are off-limits, as you request. 2. Given the high stakes involved, the traditional pre-trial scout of the forest will be cancelled for both sides. 3. 10 competitors will participate from each school, and each may have one weapon of their choice. No others may enter, and the forest will be veiled from spectator view. All magical spells and talents are allowed. 4. If both boys and girls are still in the forest when the sun rises, the trial will continue until only boys or girls are left. 5. Regardless of the outcome, Tedros's original terms will be obeyed. If the girls win, the boys will surrender to your school as slaves. If the boys win, the readers will be turned over to us for execution and the schools returned to good and evil. Any violation of these rules will void the terms of the trial and precipitate war. Best of luck, Professor Bilious Manley, Acting Dean, School for Boys. Agatha frowned, questions churning. Why had Evelyn wanted the trial scout cancelled? And why had she circled the caves if they were off-limits? She flipped to the third page, still silently fuming for even thinking of Tedros, let alone wishing for... Her heart stopped. In her hands was a long, tinnily scrawled list of potion ingredients, followed by an even longer series of precise directions for brewing them, filling up every inch of an old, tattered page. A page Yuba said he'd lost in a classroom weeks ago. Now, as Agatha stared at it here in the dean's office, a question burnt into her skull, searing away everything else. Only the question wasn't how Evelyn Seder had found the gnome's recipe for Merlin's lost spell. The question was what she had done with it. Chapter 20. One Step Ahead. On his knees, Tedros snatched another lamb chop off the floor and ripped into it like a lion, shredding off the meat and flinging the bone onto the heap of others. After devouring six more, he clutched his stomach, slightly green, trying to hold it all down. The cell door squeaked open, and he looked up at Philip, slicked with sweat, forearm streaked with dried blood, carrying two steaming mugs.
"Knew you'd overeat," Philip said, and put down a mug of frothy liquid in front of him. "Bit of rice stewed in hot water calms the stomach. Wish we had some peppermint or fresh ginger. Brew a nice digestif."
Sophie saw Tedros staring, and she cleared her throat with a macho grunt.
"Drink up."
Tedros stuck his tongue in the tea and put it down, frowning.
"Late for storian duty, aren't you, Philip? Told Manley I should interrogate you first,"
Sophie said sternly as she sat facing him. "That's why I saved his life," she scolded herself, resting her bulky shoulders against the wall, "because Tedros would tell her where the storian was. That's why. Not because she cared the slightest bit about him." She glared at him, muscles clenched, refocusing on the goal.
"Tell me where it is, Tedros."
For the last time, Tristan and I buried it to keep it away from Sophie and Agatha, he snapped. We hid it under a loose brick. I don't know how it could have moved.
He saw Philip studying him and hung his head.
Look, I wouldn't lie to you, Philip, not after what you've done for me. But who took it then?
Sophie said, stomach turning.
Did they question Tristan? Pfft, he'd be the first one to hand it over to a teacher,
Tedros groused, kicking off his boots.
Besides, no one's seen that mouse for days, probably left before classes started. Never liked the other boys. But Castor said we're all doomed if we don't fight, because the pen reflects the soul of its master.
Tedros mumbled, slumping deeper.
If it gets into Dean Seder's hands, you can bet there'll be a lot of boys dying at the end of stories, starting with mine.
Mine? The word hit Sophie harder than the prospect of Wood's wide death. She had always thought of it as her story, with Tedros the villain in her way. But now she realized Tedros thought it was his fairy tale, and that he deserved a happy ending just as much as she did.
Agatha's wish for you, Sophie said quietly.
How did you hear it?
Tedros paused, jaw clenching.
I was 9 when my mother left. It was the middle of the night, and I was asleep in the opposite wing. I remember bolting up in a pool of sweat and stumbling to the window without knowing why, my heart feeling like it was ripped open. The last thing I saw was my mother on my favorite horse, galloping into the woods.
He traced the space between bricks with his finger.
I woke up the same way when I felt Agatha's wish. She wanted me to hear it, Philip.
His eyes watered.
And I believed it was true.
Sophie fidgeted with her grubby nails.
Maybe it was true, she said, almost to herself. Maybe something just
got in the way.
Tedros rubbed his eyes and sat up straighter.
You're a good friend, Philip. You didn't have to help me.
Sophie shook her head.
I couldn't let you die,
she breathed, unable to look at him. I couldn't.
Sophie said the same thing last year, vowed to protect me in the trial, then left me to die alone,
Tedros said, picking at a hole in his dirty black sock.
Suppose that's the difference between a girl and a boy.
Sophie finally looked up, blinking wide. Tedros nodded.
Trust me, I know, Philip. She was every bit as evil as the storybook says.
Sophie swallowed.
Can you tell me about her? She was the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen. Blonde hair just like yours, and now that I think about it, green eyes a lot like yours too,
Tedros said, peering at Philip. His cellmate glanced away, uncomfortable, and Tedros quickly looked down.
But there was nothing beneath it. Every time I gave her a new chance, I saw more and more deceit. It was like she wanted a prince only to have one, caring nothing about who I actually was. I never knew what Agatha saw in her worth saving. Perhaps you don't know Agatha the way Sophie knows her. I know Agatha used to be a good soul who deserved happiness with a prince,
Tedros retorted.
Now she gave up true love for something masking as it. Sophie did that to her. Sophie ruined her.
Only because you made your princess choose,
Sophie shot back, elfish face flushing.
You're responsible for your own fate, Tedros, not Agatha, and not Sophie.
Tedros grimaced and said nothing.
Why can't a girl have both?
Sophie asked softly. She looked at her boy face reflected in the bedframe.
Why can't she have the love of her prince and the love of her best friend. Because we grow up, Philip, Tedros exhaled. When you're young, you think your best friend is everything, but once you find real love, it changes. Your friendship can never be the same after that, because no matter how much you try to keep both, your loyalty can